Hello, everyone. Welcome again to the Startup Society's Foundation podcast. Today, we're joined by Michael Castle-Miller, founder of Refugees Cities and a legal and policy consultant for special economic zones. Michael, how are you doing today?
Very good. Thanks for having me on, Joe.
Of course, no issue. So for our viewers who do not know, what is a refugee city?
Yeah, well, a refugee city is a special status jurisdiction in which countries could find a better way of handling the refugee crisis than the traditional camp model, refugee camp model. You know, since World War II, there have been, of course, a number of different refugee crises that have displaced large numbers of people. And many of the countries hosting the bulk of those refugees have been in Southeast Asia, in Africa, and increasingly in the Middle East, we've seen. And under a traditional model, most of those refugees are kept in camps that are administered by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR. And they're distributed food aid and tents, and it's intended to be a very temporary solution. So they're not allowed to work oftentimes. They're not allowed to start their own businesses in many cases. And a refugee city would completely change the paradigm by creating a special settlement in which the refugees would be given the legal right to work, to operate their own businesses, and ideally have a better business environment than is normally the case in the country. And by doing that, we can turn refugees from being considered a burden by the country into people who are treated with dignity and contribute to the economic development of the country that's hosting them.
So how do you respond to the criticisms that refugees that come into these areas, they're often low skilled or maybe even have psychological problems as part of the traumas they experienced in their home countries? How are they allowed to become productive citizens because of that?
Sure. Well, you know, people have much more resiliency than we often give them credit for. Many times we see people who truly are, of course, traumatized, coming from horrible situations, and they need support to deal with those problems desperately. And there's still, I think, a very crucial role that humanitarian organizations play in helping people do that. But you know, under the model that we often operate under, refugees will spend 10, 15, 20 years of their life in refugee camps, not able to work, not able to rebuild their lives. And ultimately, that doesn't really help overcome trauma. People are looking to get back on their feet and get moving again. So we can help them do that. And people are much more eager to respond to that. You can see that in those cases in which refugees have been resettled into developed countries. There are large refugee resettled refugee communities in the United States, in Europe, and they've demonstrated tremendous resiliency to get back on their feet, to be self-supporting in a relatively short period of time. Many of them are entrepreneurs and have created dynamic economies in several of our cities here in the United States and around the world. So there's a lot of evidence that shows that when you give refugees the opportunity to provide for themselves, to provide for their families and their communities, they do it in a relatively short period of time. There's tremendous capabilities in refugees, and you know, in part, that's probably an indication of their tenacity and drive that was shown by them making it crossing the border and trying to find safety themselves. There's incredibly, you know, scrappy, you know, make get it done type people who are exactly the type of people that would be huge assets to economies, to businesses, and of course to themselves.
Well, it definitely sounds like a win-win from my perspective, for both for the refugees and for the surrounding area, and also for the governments that are administering these refugee cities. So what are some of the obstacles or the reasons why these things are not being implemented?
Well, you know, in part, there's still it's a lot of old paradigm thinking. You know, in a lot of these countries, there's still a tremendous fear of foreigners coming in, whether they represent, you know, a threat to culture or morals or security or a threat to the economy, because they view them as, you know, competing for limited resources, including jobs. You know, there's the they'll steal our jobs type argument. And, you know, and but the encouraging thing is we're seeing a lot of change. The humanitarian world is learning that development, economic development, is the best way to ultimately solve these humanitarian crises and to help people bounce back from them sooner. So we see, for instance, the World Bank getting much more involved in forced displacement issues, and they're bringing with them, you know, proven economic development principles over into refugee crises. And we're seeing a lot of response from the NGOs and the humanitarian organizations. So we even see movement in the, within the UN and other organizations. So there's very encouraging trends with that. But you know, so the one of the great things about refugee cities is that it can go to these countries that are fearful of refugees, but that are nevertheless, whether they like it or not, they're hosting huge populations of them. Now, Turkey has 2.4, I believe it's 2.4 million refugees right now. Pakistan has about 1.4, I think, million refugees. Lebanon, a quarter of the population are refugees, and Uganda and Kenya have huge refugee populations. These are countries that they're faced with the question of, how are we going to respond to this? And if they continue responding with temporary solutions, where we try to keep the refugees confined, keep them in one place, and eventually get them out as quickly as we can, you know, the unfortunate reality is that the refugees usually tend to stay for quite a bit of time. And if that's the case, why not benefit from their presence as well as benefiting them? You know, it's a win-win for, of course, as you were saying, for the refugees and for the host community to allow them to engage in economic activity and help the country achieve its development goals.
So is there a happy medium or a compromise? Say, for instance, that these refugee cities are not in new countries like in Europe or elsewhere, but perhaps in near the home countries. I know that Saudi Arabia has these enormous camps that have the potential to house refugees. Do you see that as a viable option as well?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the countries, I think that the most promising places are these sort of frontline countries that are hosting large refugee populations, primarily because they have the most incentive to try to do something about that allows the refugees to be productive. So so I see tremendous potential there.
Excellent. And you said that the other front was sort of the NGO community that was sort of reticent to move into this sort of territory. What are some steps that, as the Startup Society's community, we can take to convince them to start trying these alternatives rather than their old strategies?
Well, I think that there has to, we have to reach out to them by showing that, look, we care about the same things. We care about the economic and social empowerment of migrants, that we are not just looking out for the interests of big businesses, but we're actually interested in the refugees themselves being able to use their skills and to be self-sufficient, which is what they want as well. So we can do that, and by showing also principles that have been shown to help societies thrive and to deliver benefits for the societies around them as well as the societies internally, and you know for you, what you're doing with startup societies. The startup societies can show the world how these new communities can work with existing social structures within it, with existing governments, and benefit the world's poor, address some of the major challenges that the world will be facing, such as climate change and the displacement that comes from climate change, from the refugee crisis to major conflicts. You know, we should be gearing the types of projects that we're working on to effectively respond to those issues that are at the forefront of global interest.
So I know that you currently work with the WEPZA, which is a world alliance of special economic zone policymakers and developers. And a lot of the people on the board include people who are on the UN and the World Bank and different government organizations. What are institutions that are most amenable to these ideas? Who could we be focusing on and trying to reach out to?
Well, you just named a few of them. You know, institutions like the World Bank, like the UN, and including within the UN, the UN Development Program, which is sort of the economic development entity within the UN, as well as UNHCR, which is deals with refugee issues, and the World Bank, which has been dealing in economic development in poorer countries since its founding. You know, these are the types of institutions that have a lot of influence around the world and a lot of expertise to make things happen. But you know, it's also working with governments, especially the governments that are hosting refugees, and with local community members, and you know, with the NGOs and the humanitarian organizations actually out there working with refugees. Because you know, a friend of mine was once urging me to get to really quickly get on the ground and to work with specific populations to make this thing happen. Because we can theorize about all this stuff. We can theorize about these great special status jurisdictions and these refugee cities and the concept, and be promoting the concept out there. But you know, the real work gets done when you're rolling up your sleeve and you're figuring out how to solve problems given the context that you're working within. And so for us, that's like we're engaging in some projects in Africa, where we're actually on the ground looking at the specific issues that are at play, and working with mayors and government and national government officials, as well as international organizations, to make something like a refugee city, a refugee special development zone, for instance, work within the realities that each country is facing.
I love how practical and nitty-gritty that is. And I'm just curious, what are some details or some obstacles that you encountered while on the ground that you never would have picked up if you were theorizing from afar?
Yeah, well, you know, one situation that is happening in Jordan, you know, has made some really impressive steps towards embracing the idea that refugees should be legally allowed to work. And they have opened up 200,000 work visas to Syrian refugees. They negotiated an agreement with the EU under which businesses that employ at least 15% Syrian workers and that are located in one of 18 different industrial zones. So they're employing Syrian workers and they're located in an industrial zone. They can sell products in the EU almost duty-free, basically at concessional tariff rates. And so, you know, there's all these kind of great measures happening to empower refugees. But, you know, one of the challenges has been it's very difficult to take the business environment in Jordan and all of its strengths and weaknesses, and to combine that with the types of businesses that you can realistically bring into Jordan right now that Jordan is competitive for, and combining that with the skills of the refugees, of Syrian refugees, of the Syrian refugees that are in Jordan, as opposed to the Syrian refugees that are either internally displaced or have moved towards Turkey and into Europe. So there's a matching issue going on. It's like, you know, what types of businesses can we realistically bring into Jordan, and that the Syrians have the skills to work with. In other countries, in Libya, for instance, there's of course challenges with security going on. It's like, we can, you know, in a nice perfect world, it's like we work with the government to draft a new law that to allow refugees to work in these designated zones, or they pass a new regulation or something, and they maybe introduce some more business environment reforms that make it more conducive to market activity. You know, in a perfect world, we do all of that. But in a place like Libya, there's you know, effectively many different people vying for power, and the official government only really controls a portion of the territory of Libya, and the rest are controlled by opposition groups or militia. So, you know, these are sort of some of the practical difficulties that you actually have to get in there and work with the stakeholders that are on the ground that know the situation and figure out how, you know, it's like, you're not going to create the perfect or the ideal scenario, but how good can we make this, the realities on the ground?
So what are some good ways we can align the incentives of local stakeholders? Because it seems that most Startup Society projects that fail because the local stakeholders, like governments, businesses, and community leaders, don't want it to happen. Is there ways we can avoid that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the best way is through dialogue and learning to understand the issues, both the political pressures and the institutional factors that are going on with the governments. You know, one of the things that refugee cities ideally is focusing on are working with countries that look at, you know, it's they're hosting huge refugee populations that they want to do something with, that won't, but they're concerned about the refugees leaking out into the cities and competing for jobs in the cities. They're concerned with them posing a security threat. But there's also, you know, for a politician, even a politician who would be very sympathetic to refugees, you know, if they do something that looks like they're allowing the refugees to compete for jobs, they could get voted out of office next year. And, you know, we see that kind of trend happening in Europe quite a bit, where there've been several politicians that have had a very open and inclusive policy towards integrating refugees. And then there's a backlash from other constituencies that rise up and take a tougher, harder line on immigration. But these are all things that we have to, like, you know, carefully position ourselves, like we've done with refugee cities, where we could say, we strike a middle ground where we say, okay, so they're not going to, the refugees aren't going to work anywhere in the country, but they can work in these designated areas. And maybe they're on greenfield sites where all of the new development is new growth, building new infrastructure, new roads, bridges, electricity, so forth, and attracting new businesses, new foreign investment into the area, which is a boon for the country, because they're often, especially in the Middle East, many countries are in bad need of new infrastructure, of new urban space, because their populations are growing rapidly and their existing cities haven't been planned to accommodate that new growth. So, you know, you have to start with what are the major issues that people in government are facing right now, and how do we work with them as hosts of our product, of our project, to help them accomplish their goals. And that's the best way to build, you know, coalitions. It's, you know, to be aiming for the solutions that where you can get, you know, 60% at least of people in the parliament or the legislature behind you, because you're showing how you can realistically solve their problems. And it's also learning to speak their language too. It's not just kind of using terminology and language that's foreign to the types of political figures or the government officials that you're working with, but learning to communicate.
So perhaps there's a way to avoid many of the tensions, because if refugees don't come only from outside of a country, they also come. There's also refugees within developed countries, like the United States. In Puerto Rico, the recent hurricanes completely destroyed all their infrastructure. Do you think we could possibly use refugee cities as a strategy to rebuild Puerto Rico and places like it?
Well, I think there's certainly room to be thinking of rebuilding Puerto Rico as a type of, you know, using special economic zone type principles to with Puerto Rico in particular. There are many cases in which U.S. law works very well throughout the 50 states, but may be inappropriate for a country like Puerto Rico, where the I believe the gross national income is somewhere around 22,000 22,000 a year. I may be wrong on that. I'd have to look that up to make sure, but it's, you know, quite a bit lower than the average in the United States. So, you know, the policies that work in the United States may not also work in Puerto Rico. So there should be room for, you know, bringing back some of the lower corporate income tax that Puerto Rico used to enjoy and that was taken away from the country. And there's some other things that we can do with the regulatory environment and that sort of thing that aren't really that are hurting Puerto Rico and that aren't really appropriate for it. So I think we can begin thinking of Puerto Rico as a project for as a place where some beneficial reforms can be launched, even if they're not launched across the United States. There's some legal difficulties with actually setting up special zones for migrants in the United States, there are some interesting proposals floated for allowing states, for instance, or municipalities to take a more active role and to take more control over the immigrants that live within their borders. And these are all, you know, these are all very interesting possibilities in the United States. But, you know, I think most of the most potential exists in these, in a lot of these countries that are, where the surges of migrants make up a sizable proportion of their population. And so that's what we're focusing on right now.
So what about America's oldest refugee camps, meaning Native American reservations? Can we use some of the strategies for those as well? They tend to be just absolute holes of poverty, and they have many policies that restrict from things like foreign direct investment and the like.
Absolutely. This is, and you know, for our country's, almost our country's entire history has been this back and forth between acknowledging Native people's rights and giving them autonomy through the land that's been that was allocated to them, to stripping it away from them, and this back and forth between heavy paternalism and respecting their rights more, and it seems like there's been many promises that we've made to that the United States government has made to the native people within the country, and then those get pulled away. That's unfortunately a black stain on our horrible mark on our record. And reservations, there could be certainly more self-determination, more of a right to manage land themselves, to administer the reservations more along the lines of what Native people want. And this is sort of kind of all fits within a broader theme of allowing devolving power more to lower levels, towards local communities, towards cities, and even down to the individual level of enabling people to provide for themselves. And that's something, refugee cities is something exactly along those lines, where we can enable rather than, there can be a lot of parallels with the situation with Native Americans in the United States, where, under traditional models, there is a lot of heavy-handed paternalism and providing, ideally meeting people's needs, but not really allowing, empowering people to provide for themselves. That's a principle that Refugee Cities is based on, is creating a space in which refugees can be empowered to provide for themselves.
There you have it. Refugee Cities, empowering refugees in order to control their own economic and governing destiny. Michael, thank you so much for coming on. It was a lot of fun.
Great. Thank you.